More than 2,000 years ago, before its sun-baked landscapes lured in travelers from around the world, Greece was busy inventing Western civilization. That's one of the reasons British actress Joanna Lumley loves it so much.
The idea that everything we know about came from Greece in the old days, the way that we do medicine, theatre, sport, politics, democracy, all these things came from Greece in the first place.
Coming up, we're taking a deep dive into the pleasures of Greece. Guides from Athens offer tips for day trips, a scenic hour or two from the busy capital.
Walking in the streets always gives me, you know, a little bit of a smile.
And they help us choose from among hundreds of islands we can visit in the blue waters of the Aegean and Ionian seas.
The whitewashed houses, the beautiful sea, the golden grass, the wonderful and delicious food.
Let's go to Greece for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Opa! It's a great big Greek hour ahead of us today on Travel with Rick Steves. Tour guides from Athens encourage us to explore beyond the big capital city into the historic sites and towns an hour or two away. And they'll help us choose a Greek island or two to relax in the sun of the Aegean or Ionian seas. We'll also share in the enthusiasm British actress Joanna Lumley has for Greece. She shares highlights with us from when she filmed her Greek Odyssey TV series a few years back. The days are long gone when the best thing about Athens was the road out of town. Today, the birthplace of democracy anchors an entertaining metro area of more than 3 million. And it also serves as a great springboard for scenic side trips and for catching a ferry or a flight to the islands. Let's start our Greek adventure looking for the sights of ancient Greece on a day trip out of the city. Tour guide Effie Perperi joins us from Athens to help out. Effie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
So, Effie, instead of focusing on Athens, I'd like to take a few minutes just to talk about the best day trips. Can you be our guide?
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure.
All right. So let's say we've got 4 or 5 days for 4 or 5 day trips. What's the first one you'd take me on?
On an afternoon tour to Sunion. Sunion, it's actually outside of Athens, roughly about an hour and a half drive, depending on traffic. And the reason why you get there is to enjoy a wonderful ride all along the coast, which ends up at the Temple of Poseidon.
So just so if our listeners can imagine this, from Athens, of course, you can go to the port, that's Piraeus, where you get the boats to all the islands. But from Piraeus, if you take a left, you'll drive along the coast until the very tip, and that's where King Aegeus would stand on that cape and look out at the sea that's named after him, the Aegean Sea.
Waiting for his son, Theseus, to return from Crete, because he went there to kill the Minotaur.
So this was an important place today for Athenians, for tourists, but also 2,500 years ago in ancient Greek times.
Exactly.
And what do you find on the cape there, on the tip?
Right now, there is the temple and a little bit of the ruins of Athena's temple. There was another temple dedicated to Athena, Sunias.
Hmm. Wow.
But it's so impressive just to go there and to see this column just standing there for 25 centuries, because it's almost contemporary to the Acropolis. So it's another classical monument.
You know, I haven't been there for almost, well, over 40 years. I went there as a backpacker.
And Hasn't changed much.
I slept in the rocks out there. I just sort of slept, and every day we'd go into the town and get our souvlaki, and we'd go back out to the rocks. And it was just a bunch of hippies hanging out in the rocks, and when they ran out of money, they'd sell some hair or sell some blood.
Well, this is the idea, even now. Now they have wonderful hotels, which are very expensive. But you can overnight at the beach or little places around the area. It's incredible.
Okay, take us to another side trip. That was a beautiful way to kick it off. We got the next day. Where are we going to go?
Next day, how about going to this island that everybody can see when they visit the Acropolis? And they ask me, oh, what is that there? Is this the Peloponnese? And I say, no, it's an island. So close. It's the island of Aegina. And right now, you can go so easily there, because you can hop on the subway, which is right across from the area where you can catch a boat to go to Aegina. And there are maybe 20 or 30 ferries going to Aegina daily. And the ticket's pretty inexpensive.
So it's just like a 45-minute ferry ride or something like that?
Yeah, depending on the type of the vessel that you're using. But in general, it is roughly an hour.
And we get away from the intensity of the big city. It's just like going into a very distant island, but it's so close to Athens.
It's a small island, so you can go around the island in just one day. As soon as when you get there, you can either stick around the city and visit Aegina, or you can take a taxi or public transportation and go to the other side of the island and do some sightseeing. Visit the temple of Athena Aphaea. That's another beautiful temple dedicated right. to goddess Athena. There's a monastery of a modern saint, Saint Nectarios.
I remember a real sleepy fishing village.
Yes. There is the popular beach of Marathonas, mm-hmm. where you can go for a swim. And numerous places where you can sample the pistachios, the Aegina pistachios.
Oh, I love pistachios.
Like the local product, yeah.
You know, Effie, I have a souvenir from Aegina.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a scar on my shoulder.
Oh, my God.
And I rented a little motorbike, and I was eating the figs that were just growing there, and my hands were all sticky. So I was holding the motorbike with just my thumb and my first finger as I was driving. I hit a bump, and I went flying head over heel, and I learned my lesson, don't drive your motorbike with sticky hands. But that reminds me, every time I look at my shoulder, of a wonderful, except for that, experience I had on the little island of Aegina. Effie Perperi is on the line from Athens to guide us to some of the great day trip options from the big city into the sights and smaller cities of the Greek mainland. You'll find a link to Effie's Facebook and Instagram pages in the notes for this week's show, plus a link to her earlier interview with us about visiting the Acropolis in Athens. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's go somewhere else. Okay, it's the next day.
The next day. So the next day you should go to the Peloponnese, which has more than one places to visit for as a day trip.
Okay, and we should remind our travelers that the Peloponnese is the big peninsula south of Athens, which is connected by a tiny spit of land cut to make the Corinth Canal. And you drive over that, which is pretty exciting, but there's so much on the Peloponnese Peninsula south of Athens. So where are we going on the Peloponnese?
Well, as soon as when you pass the Corinth Canal, there is a big rock, like a mountain, and on the top of it, there is another castle, which is called the Acrocorinth. And just at the bottom of this mountain, it's the ancient city of Corinth, which is well known to the people that love the biblical sites. But St. Paul, you know, he left his signature in the city.
So St. Paul lived in Corinth, and then later then, I understand, he wrote a letter to the Corinthians.
To the Corinthians, yes,
and that's
exactly.
the letter that's in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. People tend to go there because they want to see the Bema, they want to see the place where he stood and spoke to the Corinthians, where he lived for a year and a half of his life. But it's a city that has a lot more to offer. You can see an archaic uh-huh. temple there dedicated to God Apollo, and then we have the Roman ruins of the city. Mm-hmm. So you can have like a little trip in Greek history.
And it's just about an hour away from Athens. I remember going there once with my TV crew because we needed one site that would give me many beautiful places to make on cameras. And in ancient Corinth, there is just so much to take your imagination away. Just beyond Corinth, just a little further, is my favorite city outside of Athens, and that's Nafplion. That was the first capital of modern Greece, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And Nafplion has a lot of similarities with Athens in a good way. For example, they have a main square, which is called Syntagma Square, like Constitution Square of Athens.
Syntagma means constitution then.
Mm-hmm.
So they celebrated it right there. What year was that when Athens won its freedom from the Ottomans?
1821. It's the beginning of the revolution. But in the early 1830s is when they established the new Greek state.
Okay, so Greece, welcome to the family of nations, and Nafplion is the capital. And today, when we go there, we see so much history. There's a fortress on the hill and a fortress in the harbor that would probably have a lion with wings on him.
Well, there is a fortress called Palamidi, and you cannot miss it because it's right on top of the city. And there is a legend about this fortress. It has steps carved on the side, which are supposed to be 999 steps. I've counted the steps. They're not 999. And everybody wants to race up to the top or walk down the steps after a visit. And they get a little bit disappointed because they count about 856.
You're 150 steps short. So, Effie, we've gone to Cape Sunion. We've gone to the island of Aegina. We've gone to ancient Corinth by crossing the Corinth Canal. And we've gone to Nafplion, the first capital of Greece. just beyond Nafplion, there's a very, very impressive ancient site.
It's the ancient theater of Epidaurus. It's not just a theater, it's a whole site. It was the sanctuary dedicated to God Asclepius, the god of medicine, the god of health. And they built one of the best-kept theaters in the world, the one with the best acoustics, which we get to use until now.
So there's still a sort of a theatrical festival there. And what they can fit 10 or 12,000 people in the amphitheater in the ancient times?
It's about 14,000, the estimation, yes. It used to be half, but then they had, in the 4th century BC, they renovated the theater, so they added a few more seats. And it is the one which is known not for the capacity, but for the acoustics.
And the acoustics are amazing. And any tour guide, you've done it, I've done it. Mm-hmm. We stand in the middle of the stage floor, and our groups are halfway up in this big 14,000-seat amphitheater. And we do the Friends, Romans, Countrymen, or you do the Greek equivalent of that. And people can hear you no problem at all without modern amplification.
That's true. Every summer, I always try to get a ticket to watch one of these ancient tragedies or comedies performed, mm-hmm. part of the festival that we just mentioned. So the acoustics are incredible. Even when it's packed, you can even hear the actor's breath.
It really, really works. Mm-hmm. Effie, thank you. I just love connecting with you and learning more about all the wonders of Greece. And we're out of time, but I would like to just close our conversation with you sharing a favorite moment that you've had with family or friends when you've gone to one of these places, not in your work as a guide, but just because you wanted to go have a nice day out. One favorite memory from one of these side trips from Athens.
Well, to be honest, Nafplion is one of the places that I get to visit again and again. Every time I'm done with Athens and I want to turn back in time, I just want to decompress, Nafplion is always the place for me that makes me feel very cozy, very intimate. And walking in the streets always gives me, you know, a smile. Looking at the bougainvilleas, sitting down and talking to people. And going to smaller places is always a nice feeling.
Yeah, especially after Athens. And this is to make sure people understand Nafplio, N-A-F-P-L-I-O. Just a couple hours drive south of Athens on the Peloponnese Peninsula. I was there for a wonderful Greek Easter. And, at midnight, the fireworks go, and you just have to run for cover. It is the biggest and craziest fireworks festival I have ever been in.
That's true, that's true. And cracking the eggs, huh?
Oh, we did the cracking the eggs, too.
And after midnight, you forgot about the huge meal, the Greek Easter meal, which starts right at midnight.
People feasting all over. They've been cooking their goat or their lamb on the spit all day long, and they crack their eggs to see who's going to have good luck or whatever in the next year. Hey, Effie, thanks so much for joining us, and you've inspired us to enjoy a little more as we side trip away from Athens and enjoy the best of Greece. Ephedistol.
Ephedistol.
We'll look at your options for island getaways in Greece. And Joanna Lumley shares adventures from her Greek Odyssey TV series. That's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves.
Hello, everybody. My name is Anastasia Gaetanou. I'm Greek. I'm from the beautiful city of Thessaloniki in the north of Greece. And I've got a little tongue twister for you today, in Greek, of course. Aspri petra ξεξασπρί και απ' τον ήλιο ξεξασπρότερη. Which means a white stone is very white and from the sun it gets even whiter. Άσπρη πέτρα ξέξασπρη και από τον ήλιο ξέξασπρότερη.
With their picture-perfect whitewashed villages set against the deep blue sea, the Greek islands deserve every bit of their fame. A visit to Greece really isn't complete without staying for a few days on at least one of them. My personal favorite is the convenient charm of Hydra. Mykonos and Santorini certainly deserve their fame as well. With over 200 inhabited islands, there's no shortage of options for you to commune with the ancient beauty of Greece instead of the crowds of fellow tourists. Tour guide Apostolos Douras joins us now to help us understand the variety we have to choose from and to recommend some of his favorites among the lesser-known islands of Greece. Apostolos, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's a great pleasure.
Boy, the Greek islands are such a romantic dream for a lot of travelers, and there's so many to choose from.
Now, there's well over 100 inhabited islands, I understand, and they're organized in groups. The four groups that I think I encounter most in my travels and my travel dreaming, we've got the Cyclades, which is the main island with all the, you know, Santorini and Mykonos and the famous places we like to go. The Ionian Islands, and those are the ones on the Italian side of Greece. That's a smaller group. The ones nestled up against Turkey, the Dodokanes. And then in the north, the Sporades. Forgive my pronunciation. It's an Americanization of those names. Those four groups, can you just very briefly describe the personalities in just a sentence or two for each of them so we could refine our planning?
First of all, let's say about the Cyclades. The Cyclades, we have a group of islands. There are about 25 of them that are inhabited, so a lot of choices for someone to travel from Athens, from the port of Piraeus. Some of these islands in Cyclades, they have also airports. So it doesn't take more than 40, 45 minutes to fly from Athens, for example, to Mykonos, Santorini, Naxos. These are some of the islands that have airports of the Cyclades. And this is what we have in our image of the whitewashed houses, the beautiful sea, the golden grass, the wonderful and delicious food, seafood of the Cyclades, and the Aegean Sea. Another group, as we said, is the Ionians. The Ionian Sea had a lot of influence from Italy, obviously, from the Venetians. So if you go to Corfu, for example, you're going to think you're in Italy, you're not in Greece, because it's been affected culturally by the Italians. If you go towards the Dodecanes, to the island of Rhodes, there you can see a lot of influence by the Crusaders, that they goes back to the 12th, 13th, and 14th century. And this is something unique that you can see on the architecture of the islands. If we go towards the north of Greece, you have a complete different architecture. You don't have any more the whitewashed houses. You have the roofs made of slates, of these black stones. You have balconies in the houses. It's something very different. Also, a lot of the islands, they're more focused also on meat food. For example, goats and sheep. Each island, group of island, has its own character because it's been influenced by different cultures.
Okay, so the classic, the iconic Greek islands would probably be the Cycladic. The Italian-flavored ones are on the Italian side. The Crusaders, that was the powerhouse of the Middle Ages for trade in the Mediterranean. Rhodes is an amazing Crusader city in itself. All of them, I suppose, would have good food and beautiful beaches.
Yeah, and then we have, of course, the island of Crete to the south, which is something unique by itself because we have one of the greatest, most ancient civilizations, if not the most ancient in Europe, the Minoan civilization. So this is something unique as well, a very different island.
Apostolos, if we're thinking of the islands, crowds and heat are two concerns. When would you go? What are the pros and cons of off-season and peak season?
It depends where would you like to go. And it depends if you like swimming or not, or if you would like to go for hiking or just enjoy the landscape. I would suggest the best time to enjoy Greece, it's in June, early June, or September, after the middle of September, because school season starts in Greece on the 10th of September. So after the middle of September, it's an ideal time to visit the islands.
Because the kids are back in school, it's less crowded, but it's still warm and nice weather?
Exactly, and the sea is warm. If you're going to go in May, you will enjoy the landscape, less tourism, but the sea might be colder this time of the year.
We're exploring the lesser-known islands of Greece now with our guide Apostolos Douras on Travel with Rick Steves. Apostolos has been working in tourism in Greece now for almost 20 years and is a student of international politics. And as you might tell from his voice, he used to work as a presenter on Greek radio, hosting Love Songs in the Evening. Apostolos offers tours of modern Athens and organizes small group tours of Crete in the northwest of Greece. His website is wondersofknowledge.com. Now let's talk about jumping from island to island. I've found that the ferries go out from Athens in kind of a, a charm bracelet. It stops at each little charm on the bracelet, and different ferries have different routes. If you choose several islands on the same ferry route, you'll have daily ferries coming through. But you can also go the other way with less common ferries. To what degree can you just hop aimlessly from island to island from a ferry point of view?
There are many routes. There are many ferry routes. And now in Greece, we have fast ferries like speedboats and also the slow ferry. So you might be in an island in an hour, or it might take you 2 or 3 hours to get to an island. If you take the boat to the same island, it might take you 6 to 8 hours. So now you can have the choice, depending, of course, on your budget. If you take the slow boat, it costs less than taking the speed boat. And many islands, they're interconnected. The smaller islands, they're connected to bigger islands always. Like from the island of Naxos, for example, or Mykonos, or Santorini, depending where geographically they're situated.
It's a lot like flying in the airplane system in the United States. You fly from big city to big city, and you connect to smaller cities near that hub. The same would be true for the ferry service, I would imagine.
Yes, and something I would like to add is, like, recently we have a new metro line that connects the airport to the port of Athens, and that helps a lot. So in an hour from the airport, you can be in Piraeus at the port of Athens getting a boat, and that helps a lot.
Now, when you're on an island, talk about ways you can get around the island, because it's really nice to be able to go to away from the port town. A lot of islands have one major town, one major port, but everybody goes there because that's the entry point and the departure point. But you can get away from the crowds and find the peaceful places if you take that initiative to go to the far side of the island.
Usually the main village of the island where the port is, it's the one which is mostly developed, where there's a lot of accommodation. But usually there's a capital, the second town, which is usually built on the top of a hill. And you can go from one place to the other on an island by taking small boats that goes around the island. Internally, you can rent a car, depending how big the island is, for example, or there are bus routes that you can get the bus timetable from your hotel. And you can go from one village to the other. So you can have that option as well. So it doesn't mean you need to have a car. Obviously, having a car on a big island, it's very helpful because you can make your own plan. But don't forget, many islands, they're very well organized, having to do with public transportation. So especially when you're traveling off-season, the buses are not going to be full with people and there's not going to be a lot of traffic.
And I would think the buses are very inexpensive.
Oh, super. Like €2 for a ticket. Very inexpensive. And you can have printed or on your phone your schedule. And the local people always are so helpful. You can always ask them when the return bus going back to town. Yeah. And everyone speaks English pretty much. So I don't see there's going to be any problem of communication.
When you arrive at an island, should you have a hotel or a bed and breakfast reserved in advance, or do people meet the ferry and try to get you to come to their accommodations?
I would say nowadays it's better if you book before a room, a hotel, or an Airbnb, unless you really go off season. If you go, for example, like towards the end of October or after Easter holidays. But I would suggest book before.
Booking in advance. So you're in a town and you have a choice. You want to, you're there for the beaches. You want to lay on the beach and take a little swim. There's different kinds of beaches that you could choose from. When I was on Mykonos, there was it was just like a string of beaches and it progressed. It went family-friendly beach, kind of a jet-setter beach with a disco and dancing and with a meat market and all the beautiful people. And then beyond that, a nude beach. And then you could go to the other side of the island and have an empty beach that was just dramatic and peaceful and you felt like you were all alone on an isolated island. Does that kind of explain the variety of beaches?
It does, and you're absolutely right. It depends how would you like to spend your vacation. You can go to an isolated beach and you can be just you and just a couple of other people. And you can sit down under the shade of, you know, a small tree and put your towel on the sand and just enjoy. But if you want, you can go to a more cosmopolitan beach where you can go to a small beach bar, for example.
Yeah.
And you would like to go and rent a sunbed. So there's something for everyone, I would say, depending your taste. And of course, you just have to ask the locals when you can find, of course, information on the internet, mm-hmm. but the best is to ask the local people when you're there for the type of beach you would like to go. But you can still find that even in the most cosmopolitan places, if you want to isolate from the crowds, you still can. But of course, I would say try to avoid these places in July and August.
What about nude beaches? Is that still a thing?
It is the same, yes. If people they want to go and swim nude, they can. Usually there are special beaches where you can go and enjoy, and it is not considered a taboo if you go to a beach and you can go nude swimming. Of course, you wouldn't go to a family beach. It's common sense. But there's no issue with that. If you would like to do that, you can definitely do that pretty much in all the islands.
I think the issue is not can you do it or not, but will you get sunburned or not?
It is. And so I have to say only one word, sunscreen. Because many people, when they come to Greece, they go to the islands and then you see them and, you know, it can be very hurtful. So I would say, you know, wear your sunscreen and your hat and you're going to be just fine. But it has to be number one on your packing list.
And especially skin that has never seen the sun. A lot of us don't realize, your arm is used to the sun, but other parts of your body, be careful.
Exactly.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Apostolos Doros. We're learning some tips about enjoying the Greek Isles. Apostolos is from Athens. He organizes small group tours around Greece, and his website is wondersofknowledge.com. Apostolos, it's so fun to talk about these Greek islands, and it's such an important topic for so many travelers who are going to Greece and they want to get out of Athens. If you are going to the islands and you've done your beach time or you don't want to go to the beach, what are some other highlights of the islands? Just quickly review the different attractions you might enjoy, pastimes.
First of all, you can go for a nice walk in town to explore the town, the architecture. You can sit down and have a coffee in the main square of the main village on an island and interact with the locals. You can visit a museum because all islands have pretty much an archaeological museum. You can go and find out about the local history that it can cover mm-hmm. thousands of years, as you know, in Greece. And also, if you happen to be there during the summer, especially July and August, do participate in a religious festival, as we call it Panigiri, mm-hmm. where the local people, they meet, they dance, they share their food, and they're having a wonderful time, and you can explore the local island culture through dancing and food. So don't miss that. If you're there, always ask the locals, is there a religious festival at the moment we can participate? I definitely recommend that.
I have got beautiful memories of exactly that. If you hit a festival, a religious festival, I've always found that the islanders love to have a traveler in their midst, partying with them, dancing with them, eating and drinking with them. I'm thinking, I just want to get back to one practical issue. I found it confusing because there were different ferry companies and I couldn't get the complete schedule unless I went to the port authority. There's like the harbor police and they know every boat. Nowadays, how do you know definitively when's the next ferry to Patmos or Ios or Naxos from your island? Where do you find that information?
First of all, there are so many websites you can find the information online about the ferries. But also, if you happen to be on an island, there's always by the port a main tourist agency where all the schedules are written outside the local travel agency. You can just walk in and mm-hmm. ask them and you can book your tickets there.
Very important advice. Thank you. And I was thinking, Apostolos, most Americans that go to a Greek island are going there by cruise ship. And I would think the big cruise ships go to four or five islands and the smaller cruise ships go to more islands than that. But when the cruise ship docks, that island suddenly becomes crowded with tourists. What is your advice for somebody who's visiting the islands on a cruise ship?
It depends how much free time you have in one of the ports. If you have enough free time to escape the crowds and go and see something out of town, that will help a lot so you can see more of the local color. And I would suggest do your research before if you have free time in one of the main towns so you know exactly where you're going to be going and where you're going to be seeing, and that makes perfect time management.
Here's a tip that I like. I was doing a Mediterranean cruise one time, and the last stop before returning to Athens at the finish of the cruise was Mykonos. and I arranged to leave the ship on Mykonos and spend a couple of days on Mykonos and being an independent traveler, and then taking a ferry or an airplane back to Athens. And the happiest moment for me, when I took my bag off of that big ship with 3,000 tourists, I checked into my little bed and breakfast, and I sat on the beach, drinking my ouzo, watching the cruise ship sail away with all of the tourists. And the sun was going down, and Mykonos took on a whole different personality. I had my efficiency in front of the cruise, but I had two beautiful vacation days without all of that intensity. That was a lovely opportunity, and I'll never forget it, and I'll never regret it.
I can imagine. It must have been a unique experience because you just feel free. You have your own time. You can do whatever you like. So I would like to be in your own place as well. I have lived that moment, of course, under other circumstances, being in a small town, in a village, seaside village, just looking at the boats come and go and just relaxing and contemplating the universe, just relaxing and thinking about your life.
Yeah, contemplating the universe or just contemplating your navel. You know, you don't have to be into anything big, or you can be into something big, but there's nothing like the joy of a cruise and then the joy of being off the cruise and being on the island without the tourists.
Very smart, Rick.
Apostolos Duros, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you in Greece next time I'm flying into Athens. Thanks so much, and enjoy your island time.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure. Enjoy the Greek islands.
You'll find web links to our guests with the notes for each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's come back to the Greek mainland next in the delightful company of British actress Joanna Lumley. She's long had a special affection for Greece, and a few years back, she filmed a charming 4-part TV series on her travels there. She takes us along from Athens to the north of Greece next on Travel with Rick Steves. Landing on the wrong Greek island on a youthful holiday never deterred Joanna Lumley from having the time of her life and falling in love with Greece. A few years back, as Greece was plunging into a lengthy economic recession, the British actress and TV presenter traveled with a film crew to create a 4-part video series called Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey. In it, she sees the sights and meets the people, from the Parthenon to Mount Olympus, from Corfu to the Turkish border, as she wanders well off the usual tourist trails. Joanna Lumley returns with us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives to share her encounters from Athens into the north of Greece. Joanna, welcome back.
Hello, Rick.
Joanna, you have a particular passion for Greece. Where did that come from?
I do. I just love it. Well, the idea that everything we know about came from Greece in the old days, the way that we do medicine, theatre, sport, politics, democracy, all these things came from Greece in the first place. My sister was named after her Greek godmother, Eleni. I couldn't wait to get to Greece, and the first time I went there, I was only 18. Absolutely fell in love with it, with the kindness of the people, with the extraordinary resilient nature of the populace there, which I think is largely because they're a maritime nation and actually were always at war with each other within the islands and within the regions, but are now united under the blue and white flag of Greece.
And that blue and white flag of Greece flies from the Acropolis. And I just love standing on top of the Acropolis and thinking back to the golden age of Greece. And you've got the Parthenon there and the scant remains, but the powerful and evocative remains of the grandeur of Greece at its cultural pinnacle. And you stand there under that blue and white flag and you can look out and see almost half of all the people in that country from that perch in Athens with that magnificent city all around you. And then you turn around and you see the Parthenon, the greatest temple of the ancient world. Now, I've been there filming, and I didn't have quite the connections you had, and we had to stand behind the ropes and film it from the ground around it. You got to go inside, and not only inside, but up into it. Tell us about filming in the Parthenon.
It took a long time and a great deal of careful and, you know, diplomatic negotiations, and they kindly let us in. It is absolutely awesome. All the things that I'd learnt about it before, which is that the pillars aren't straight, because to give the impression of straightness, they are curved and that they aren't in a straight line.
So I love that concept architecturally. Architects know that if you have a long straight line, like a baseline, the illusion it'll be sagging even if it's straight. So they bend it up just a bit so
Isn't
that it looks straight.
And Rick, you could even standing outside, you could see the immensity of those columns. And you think, how on earth did they manage to build one, let alone all of those, let alone with the pediments and the roofs and the inner temples of them? And then right up high, they said, and the cameras were rolling, otherwise I promise you I wouldn't have done it. They said, oh, here's your stepladder, Gianni. You're just going up here. And I said, what do you mean? Because I've got a very bad head for heights. They said, oh, you're going to climb up and see the work that they're doing.
I remember watching that. It was so exciting to watch you getting drawn up into the scaffolding up high on the Parthenon.
Right,
and then you looked back at the camera and you said, this is for the viewers. I wouldn't do this otherwise. I love you.
They were working with dentist's tools, tiny picks, tiny little brushes, just working round a horse's leg or the face of somebody, a little bit of acanthus leaf. They were working away right so high up you could only see it with a spyglass if you were on the ground. And they've made the most wonderful museum, which again is air-conditioned and all the pieces of the Parthenon, which actually you wouldn't be able to see it, even if it was in perfect condition, because it's all miles above your head.
Yeah.
So all the bits that have tumbled down or have been broken down are all now at eye level, and you can examine them.
So this is the new Acropolis Museum you're talking about, in the shadow, literally in the shadow of the Acropolis.
Shadow.
And in
Absolutely
the old days, you
beautiful.
Would go across town to the big National Museum of Archaeology, but today you want to, if you have limited time, it's right there. It's a state-of-the-art museum right there in the Acropolis, long awaited, and that's where you find the stone and carved treasures of the Acropolis taken out of that acidic air of that big city of millions and millions of people and safely on display for all of us travelers. You know, Joanna, later that night you were at a party and you were talking about how they don't throw the plates anymore.
I don't know where the plate smashing thing came, but it's one of those old sort of canards which appears every time you mention Greece. They go smash, smash the plates.
Mm-hmm.
They said rather dismissively, we haven't smashed plates for years.
But they
urban
do throw
myth.
Flowers.
But anyway, they do throw flowers. They love to party. And when we visited, they were just at the beginning of their real, real financial crisis. But unbowed, blooded but unbowed, they went on dancing, they went on buying flowers, carnations and things like that, which they would throw onto the stage, shouting applause for whichever pop singer or, you know, ballad singer was singing at the time.
Welcome to Caramella.
My host tonight is nightclub owner Yanis Boitipakos, which means naughty boy.
We live for today, for this day.
For this moment.
Yes, for the moment. We don't care for tomorrow.
And you party all
tomorrow may be everything.
Everything boom.
Fun to balance your sightseeing experience with climbing around the Acropolis and then going to a party in the evening where they're throwing flowers.
Honestly, can you imagine? It was quite extraordinary. But Greece does hit you like that. It's the modern and the ancient all rolled up in one, every day and everywhere you go.
Joanna, you're probably the most British person I think I can remember interviewing. And when you go to the Acropolis, of course, the issue is the art treasures of the Acropolis are to a great degree in London. And Greeks would love to have those Elgin marbles that were taken to England ages ago and are now beautifully displayed in the British Museum. They'd like it back in their what they consider the rightful place in the Acropolis. And London always says, well, you don't have a safe and proper place to put it, so they're better off in London. Now the Greeks have made this state-of-the-art museum, and they've actually got a place sort of poignantly vacant and waiting for the return of those Elgin marbles. As an English traveler and a proud Brit, what's your take on that?
I know I have to tread terribly carefully around this one because, you know, in my girl guide thing, you go, yeah, give them back tomorrow. But of course, I've done a bit more research about it. One is that it was under the Ottoman Empire that the marbles were sold to Lord Elgin, and he retrieved them because at the time the Parthenon was falling down and everything was being taken away and reused, smashed up. It was not being looked after or loved. And he got these treasures, said, I'd like to buy them, and whoever the Ottoman overseer was said, yeah, you can have them for whatever it was, and they were taken and carefully brought back and are now, as you can imagine, the crown of glory in the British Museum. I have talked on both sides of the fence about this because I know the Greeks are absolutely adamant that they should be given back. The British Museum's take on it is that they will be seen by far more people because so many more people come to the British Museum than actually ever go to Athens. The second thing is that they say, if everything that came from a country must go back to the country, what are we going to say to our art galleries? Does every French impressionist painting have to leave the walls of Chicago and come back to France? Mm-hmm. I mean, when does it end? When things have been bought at a cost which is now considered wrong and taken away and treasured and looked after somewhere else. So we're all in a bit of a muddle about this. I'm not quite sure what the thing is. I know that we also have, from Egypt, we have the Rosetta Stone in the British Museum, but I've also seen the Rosetta Stone in Egypt, the fake Rosetta Stone. You could put me up against a wall with a gun to my head and I couldn't tell you which was which.
Right.
So now we can do copies so brilliantly. Maybe that's the way around. Maybe they're copies in the British Museum already.
Maybe you wouldn't know. Yeah, but you're sort of making a case that conceivably the precious Elgin marbles might not have survived through these crazy ages had not...
Oh, no, they wouldn't have. They would have been utterly destroyed. And so, they would have been also... The air was so bad that they were all corroding away like mad.
I've been in the sacristy or the treasury of St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, and it's got some of the most precious treasures from Constantinople that were basically looted and plundered from Constantinople back in the old days, centuries ago. And you can make a very good case that they would have never survived to this day had they not been taken into a more stable environment of Venice instead of Constantinople. And for that reason, they survive. And for that reason, they're in Venice and not in Constantinople.
It's really difficult. It's a really difficult problem because other times, other customs, I don't know. It's always worth thinking about, though. And I talked and talked and talked. And of course, everybody in Greece said, bring them back. And there's a beautiful statue, which I'm sure you've seen, of Melina Mercouri, the most confident and passionate advocate for the return of the Elgin marbles. Mm-hmm. And there she is, her face turned upwards to the Parthenon, shouting and eyes blazing, saying, bring us back our marbles. Anyway, I've put in my plea, but the chances are they're not going to go back, I think.
Joanna Lumley's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to recall what a delight it was to film her four-part TV series, Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey. You might find it on a public TV schedule from time to time, on DVD, or from a variety of streaming services. Joanna, one thing I enjoyed about your series on Greece was this trip across the north of Greece. You went from Corfu, which is the island people sail to from Italy on the way to Greece, and then instead of heading on down to Athens like everybody does, you went north along the border, just south of Albania and Macedonia and all the way over to the border, the troubled border of Greece and Turkey. In that trip, first of all, Corfu, part of it has a nickname Kensington on the Sea. What's that all about?
I know. Because it's got such an English influence. It was mostly Italian, actually, the Italian architecture and so on. So it looks like a very Italian island. But the English, for some reason, it adopted Englishness and it loved cricket.
And you popped in on an aristocratic guy who has a mansion right on the beach there.
Count Flamboriari, who's just extraordinary, the most charming and delightful man. And the whole of Corfu is bewitching. It's quite unlike the rest of Greece, I should say. It's got a very Mediterranean feeling to it as opposed to Aegean.
It feels a little more Italian or something to me.
Yes.
Now, you went further north, and this is where I've never talked to anybody who's traveled here, and it was right on the border of Albania, and it was all mountains and pure, pure nature. This was Lord Byron traveled there and was inspired by it.
Oh, it's just extraordinary. He rode up there to go into Albania with his friend Harold Hobhouse. But I just was there just for a little bit, riding up to one of the monasteries where he spent a night when there was a storm. And just at the time we were filming it, a great storm rolled in, we think sent exactly by Byron.
That was great. And you had the cameras rolling in that remote
cameras
place.
Rolling, the horses off camera. The horses were rearing. We were rushing for cover. And it was an absolute cloudburst, which is exactly what he'd written about in his diaries.
Perfect.
So it was pretty thrilling.
This is thrilling. Even the wine explodes. Fantastic. This is brewed here on the premises. It's red champagne. No wonder Byron's dead. I just say the name Byron and it goes mad.
And meeting the monks who stewed their own wine and, oh, my goodness.
It was so remote and such an example of how when you go that extra mile, you'll find those serendipitous moments that make travel really, really vivid. Mm. Later on, you managed to enjoy some oil wrestling. Now, I've seen oil wrestling in Turkey, but this was in Greece. How is it that there's Turkish oil wrestling in Greece, and what a beautiful thing to film?
What a beautiful thing to film. I think because the borders have always been porous. In places where you're very close to somewhere, you get customs over the border, as it were. You can't divide people by a line or by a passport area. People follow different things. They follow customs, they follow languages, they follow geography. They aren't to be divided by a line in the sand. So I hate it. I hate walls.
There's a little bit of Muslim Turkey in Greece. There's a little bit of Greek Orthodox Christian in Turkey.
We must celebrate that. And the oil wrestling was entirely Turkish. and has been adopted and kept in Greece, where they simply adore it. The oiliest men you have ever seen.
But these are good-looking men, and you're just slathered with oil. It's quite sexy to watch.
With olive oil. And slippery as all. And, of course, then they fall on the grass, and the grass is covered then with oil. It's like a skating rink. So good humour, honestly. If you were a maiden aunt, you would avert your eyes slightly. But it was done with such good humour and such passionate determination during the fights and such good kindness and
nice
sportsmanship quality at the end of it. I loved it.
And then, very naturally, from there you went to biblical sites, and you're in Philippi, where the first European baptism was. Talk about that.
That was extraordinary. To look at the stream where St. Paul, travelling up, recently converted himself, coming up from Tarsus, travelling up through into Europe, which must have been an unknown place to him, and of course it wasn't Europe then, but the European regions, and he baptised a woman, she was the very first convert. Why can't I remember her name?
Was it Lydia?
Was it Lydia?
Yeah.
It was Lydia. Mm-hmm. He baptised Lydia in the stream. And to stand at the stream where Paul baptised Lydia, which has now got a dear little church there, where they were having a baptism that very day.
So Paul was the first great missionary, great traveller, and he was, imagine the courage and the passion and the thrill of him going to a place like Philippi and then talking Lydia into getting baptized and establishing the church right there in the north of Greece.
And establishing the church.
In the first century.
All I knew about Philippi was Shakespeare's thing, I'll see thee at Philippi from Julius Caesar. So it was thrilling in every way.
Joanna, when you think about the Orthodox Church, a lot of people who would go to church in farther to the west, they've got more modern rituals and so on. And you go to the Greek Orthodox Church and it just almost seems intentionally old-fashioned and ancient. But it's sort of a passion for that continuing the tradition in the honest, original way. And I think when
That's right.
go to an Orthodox church, you got to respect the fact that they don't celebrate being modern. They celebrate being true to the ancient rituals. And you find that today all over the Orthodox world.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in the more modern Christian world, it seems that they've changed the language, they've changed the shape of the services, they've changed so much about it that sometimes you'd think, is this, have I come to the right place?
Yeah.
But not so in the great orthodoxies of Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox.
You could pop into an Orthodox church any time in the last 1,500 years and it's probably just about the same.
Unchanged.
Candles and icons.
Isn't it interesting?
Well, from there, you then got into this crossroads area between East and West, and you dealt in your show just beautifully with that very harsh population swap, almost ethnic cleansing, where
the
Muslim
Black Sea
Greeks were sent over to Turkey and Christian Turks were sent over to Greece.
It was done by people sitting at a desk with paper and pencil in front of them and saying, well, look, if all these people here originally who live around the Black Sea, if they're originally Greeks and are Christians, why don't we get them all back to Greece? This was when the Ottoman Empire had come to an end in the 1920s, I think it was, early 1920s. And as ever, the people who were concerned were not the ones sitting and making the lines. I think it was the Americans, the French and the English drawing all these lines up, the British rather. And they decided that to send anybody of Turkish descent back into Turkey, they had nothing to do with Turkey. They spoke Greek. They happened to be Turkish and maybe of the Muslim faith, but they weren't Turks. They were Greeks.
Yeah.
And then the other way around.
And some of them chose to stay. You went up to Xanthi, this little enclave of Muslims in the middle of Greek Orthodox Christian Greece.
Wasn't that extraordinary? And suddenly, having come from all the religiousness of St. Paul's bringing Christianity up, suddenly to find a little mosque and children studying the Quran in an entirely Muslim village.
And they were remote. They were very camera shy, weren't they?
They were shy. They were very charming. The younger ones were charming. And actually, I think it's really the cameras people often shy away from, because when the cameras weren't turning, everybody was terribly kind. Tobacco was their main crop, and they got a tiny amount of money for it. And they picked the tobacco, back-breaking work, most of it planted by women.
You actually went out there and planted some tobacco yourself. That was beautiful.
I did. I wonder how it went.
Yeah. It was hard work, it looked
like. I know.
Like. Yeah. And the women had to do all the bending over.
They did all the bending, and then the chaps come along and water it with watering cans, so it was made a bit easier for them.
Wow. We're capping this hour about Greece on today's Travel with Rick Steves with an interview we enjoyed recording with British actress Joanna Lumley after she filmed her Greek Odyssey TV special. You can look for it now on YouTube and on video streaming services. And Joanna, we've been traveling with you across the north of Greece and traveling the perimeter of the north of Greece. What an evocative and just eye-opening sort of experience. When you think back on your experience on this part of Greece, what saddened you and what made you happy?
What made me happy was to go to Thrace. I don't know why, but it's a word that I'd known all my life and have always studying atlases and maps. The idea of going to Thrace, which is this extraordinary area. What saddened me, of course, was going through Thrace to Evrost in the extreme eastern part of Thrace where Greece meets the Turkish border is, of course, hostility again. Mm-hmm. And so there are gun emplacements and army encampments on each side and a great sense of tension there. And it was difficult to film, and it was... And you think, people... I looked around, and the countryside was as beautiful and as tranquil, with birds singing and mm-hmm. trees bearing fruit. And you think, why are we fighting? That's what made me think, why are we fighting? But I live in hope, actually, Rick, and I know you do too, because if you travel, you always live in hope.
Joanna, thank you for all the work you put into producing Joanna Lumley's Greek Odyssey, and I want to talk to you after your next adventure. Thanks a lot, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Rick. Goodbye.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Kazmira Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Special thanks to the BBC in London for studio help this week. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Imagine a community of well-traveled friends who love sharing tips and comparing notes. That's our online community. It's called the Rick Steves Travel Forum. You can read trip reports, reviews, and share itinerary planning questions, peruse the topics, or post your own submissions. It's at ricksteves.com, and you're invited.